Welcome to Ojibwe Stories, Gaga Nunanada. I'm Eric Reddix. Our guest today is Larry Amick Smallwood, who grew up in Ajimoog, the Lake Lena district of Mille Lacs. He has worked as a language instructor for the Minneapolis Public Schools, the Neosheng School, the Leech Lake Tribal College, and the University of Minnesota Duluth. Since 1999, he has served as director of language and culture for the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe. Larry talks about seasonal changes and the messages that nature gives us. If you'd like to talk a little bit about growing up speaking Ojibwe and when you first started speaking Ojibwe, maybe when you first started speaking English.
I was born in the late 40s, and I was raised by my mother's aunt and uncle. They only spoke Ojibwe in a house, so me being raised by my mom's aunt and uncle, I learned Ojibwe when I was before I was a year old. It's the first language that I ever spoke. Not till I got into grade school when I started speaking English, and that's where I learned how to speak English. When I started school, I was out there, they didn't have kindergarten or they didn't have preschool or any of those kinds of things. We just went from the house to the first grade. When I started school, I didn't know it was culture shock. I didn't know what was going on. I just know I was supposed to be in school, you know. They told me you're going to be going to school now. So I sat there that first day, and they were all talking English, and I didn't understand. I was just looking at my surroundings. And all the way from the time I got on this little bus in Duxbury, Minnesota, going to Cloverton, Minnesota, 15-mile bus ride, and I learned my surroundings as I was going, and when I got to the school, I studied everything on the way over there. I didn't know what was going on, really. You know, I wanted to run away. I could run away. I don't know how to get back, you know. But I couldn't speak English, but the teacher knew that and knew my folks. And so when they called the first graders up there, I went up there and joined them, you know, because I was in the first grade, I guess, was the row I was sitting in. So she was reading them stories and asking them questions, and I was looking at the pictures and looking at all that writing there, and looked up at the wall way up there, and there was English writing, English letters up there, and started checking all those out. And then I couldn't wait for the first day to get through so I get home and speak my own language. But I remember my first English sentence after I put it all together. It was probably somewhere around the last part of the September, after a month of school. There was storybook time, and there was a little girl there pointing at a cat running. And there was an older lady in that picture, presumably her mother, and the words down there, those little three-letter words, said, "See the cat run." And I said, "Oh, that's probably what that means." And I was looking at those little letters, "See the cat run." Well, by now I was learning my ABCs too. So I thought, "Wow, I can speak English. See the cat run." I don't remember anything the rest of the day except "see the cat run." So when I got home, I found the cat and I told my mom, "Ma, go jing be shan. Nee, waben dang gego. Nishagan ashim gay." I said, "Come on outside, I want to show you something. I can speak English." So I grabbed the cat and I put her down, but she didn't run. So I kicked it, and it ran, and I pointed, and I looked at my mom, and I said, "See the cat run." And she looked at me. "Honey, did I show you this in?" So I went and got the cat again. I said, "Wait, bake up, Mom." I put that cat down again. Before I kicked it, it ran off, and I said, "See the cat run." I'm talking English. So, you know, that was in September, last part of September. By the time December came around, I can speak English well enough, and I was on a little Christmas program there where they recited little Christmas pieces there, and I think I had like three lines or four lines that I knew really good. And by the time school was out in June, I could speak English just like I can today, a few little words more. So that was when I started speaking English when I was in the first grade. And that's why I say today immersion works, because I was immersed in that English language for 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, you know, and from September to June. And it was December when I could speak English.
So then when you came home after school and that summer, it was still all Ojibwe and your family, right?
Exactly. And then, you know, we had our ceremonies that I went to. I understood the ceremonies. I understood what was being said. I did the things that I was supposed to do and all that. You know, it was a culture shock, too, when I got into fifth grade. See, I grew up with all my traditions out there in the settlement where I lived in eastern Minnesota, there east of Hinckley, about 25 miles. We had our midday camps set up. I went through that when I was like 7 years old. We had our big drum ceremonies going on back then. See, we never put any of our ceremonies aside or went underground with them. We kept them right out in the open. You know, don't bother us. You know, we're traditional here. We can do what we want to do pretty much. But when I was in the fifth grade, I remember a car pulling up. It was this elderly gentleman got off with snow white hair. And it was probably around, it was the springtime, it was warm, but he had a trench coat on, a black one. And he was carrying all kinds of contraptions, and the teacher looked out and she said, "Oh, Reverend so-and-so is here. Who wants to go to religious instructions?" Oh, a few little hands went up. So I asked my friend up ahead of me there, Johnny Mishler. I said, "Hey, Johnny," I said, what is religious instructions?" "Oh," he said, "we get to go and drink Kool-Aid and have cookies, and we get to watch movies of people in different countries, different lands." And all. I'm going. Sign me up for the religious instructions. Wow. So I went. And somewhere along the line, in the course of religious instructions there in the next few weeks, I found out some of the stuff they were telling me was pretty scary in that religious instruction class. You know, like I was going to burn in hell forever if I said the wrong thing or did the wrong thing. And then once again, I went home to my mom and I said, "Mom, we're going in. In gooding gimme gimme chagas a minute, kinna." "Huh?" I said, "In gooding gimme gimme chagas a minute, kinna. Anin dana isha wabisi an anin diga on dina man minu ayo. Ogi pisha o. O gagi kwe nini yiduga. Miga isha yang etu vidi. Ishpin gego o. Don't you even go back over there. So she gave me a lecture about going back to religious instructions, but you know, that didn't stop me. Because that gentleman scared the heck out of me. You know, so holy cow, what if there's some truth to this? So at nighttime, I would silently pray, "Forgive me, Jesus. I did this today." You know, that really did something to me. All the way up until the time I was 32 years old, I would silently pray at night going to bed. But meanwhile, during the daytime, you know, I was still putting my tobacco out, so I guess I was kind of covering my butt, you know, to make sure there's some truth to what he's saying, you know. I want to make sure I'm going to the right place there. But, you know, I sat for 30 days at a treatment facility and thought about these things, and by then I'd been teaching language and culture and listening to a lot of spiritual advisors, spiritual leaders, and some of my own people back home in Mille Lacs and Ojibwe, and also I'd been up to Canada and all over out east and talked and listened to a lot of these spiritual advisors. They all had the same thing to say. You know, I said, I know that there's not a book where they learned this from, and I know how old man so-and-so over in eastern Wisconsin can say the same thing somebody says up in Manitoba, and there's some truth to this. So it was in that treatment facilities where I kind of found my identity, so to speak, and made me a believer in our ways, a strong believer in our ways. I always did believe in them, but I was that religious instruction has kind of messed me up. And from then on, from the time I was 32 years old, and you know, I'm a traditional Shinabe, I speak my language, I use my Seba, I do this and I do that, and that's how I am today. So.
I was wondering, too, the family you were raised in, how did they make their living when you were a younger boy?
When I was young, I used to watch the old man. See, he couldn't speak any English, a few words here and there, and so did my My mom, that's what I call her now. But he would work for the local farmers around the area during the summertime, and he would cut pulpwood during the wintertime. And also he had, there were some cabins around the two Tamarack Lakes out there, and there was probably about seven cabins altogether. And from May to probably late September, he would mow those lawns around those cabins because we lived right on the lake. And he would upkeep those cabins. Mm-hmm. And then when those guys come up in the weekends that owned those cabins, they would give him, you know, 10, 20 bucks for each lawn. And he was making good money back then, 150, 200 a week. They're just mowing lawns and taking care of the houses. So that's how he made his living. And then plus he was a trapper too. So he did a lot of trapping of beaver and mink. She was a housewife, but a lot of people would come to her, local people would come and ask her to mend something as far as sewing goes, and she made blankets, and she made moccasins, and she made this, and all those things.
I wonder if you could tell us about the changing nature of the season and what nature tells us.
Well, you know, I used to hear them, those people that raised me, you know, back in the late 60s and mid-70s, they say, "Hey, go good thing we show you, but something is going to happen someday." Is what they used to say. The time is coming for the earth, for the end of the world, they would say. People are doing too many things here on earth, and it's harming the earth. I listened to that. And you can see with big icebergs melting up north and what's happening with our crazy weather down here now. I mean, like last year in March, we had 70-degree weather, and then this year in May, we're having snowstorms. And last year, the walleyes on Mille Lacs, they were kind of confused. And this year, the ice didn't go off the lake till just a few days ago.
Yep.
And then they used to say, too, you know, Gawangabe, Epogosasino, Ashkeshe, and all Wabos, Pogosid Manager. They would say the deer and the rabbits and those wildlife didn't taste anymore like how they used to taste. And my wisecrack was, well, geez, you're 80 years old, you're 90 years old, your taste buds probably no good anymore. But now I see that, you know, I believe it. There's some truth to what they're saying. I don't know if you want to call it global warming. If it's global warming, I don't think so. You know, look how cold we were here in May. And also all the chemicals in the lakes, they're polluting the lakes. And then we have these invasive species coming up on the boats and from other places. You know, the whole thing is going, it's not right. It's going out of sync. You know, there's times too, you know, the maple sugaring. Some of these guys that go out and harvest the maple sugar, you know, there were tapping trees here. And they were still getting water here, even after it rained and after the moths come out and after the frogs come out. They were still tapping water and still trying to make syrup. You know, we should have just let those trees be till the next year. You know, you always have to have your test trees out there, one or two of them, to see how it is and then leave it alone, you know. And a lot of my friends are tapping. So, oh, this one guy said, "Oh, I got so many gallons of boil." I said, "My God," I said, "moths and all that thing, those have been out, the frogs been croaking, and it's been raining." I said, "You can't do that." He said, "Yeah, oh yeah." I said, "Okay." So I'm not going to taste the syrup either.
Does that kind of come from your family then, these kind of regimented teachings about when we're supposed to stop doing certain things like sugaring and when we're supposed
to start? Nature tells you that. If you're a good Shinabe person, you can tell. You know, nature, she'll let you know. Pay attention to that. Pay attention to nature. Mm-hmm. You know, it'll give you all the signs. Yeah. You know, and then there's things that happen when you don't pay attention to nature.
Did you ever hear a teaching about blue jays? Their kind of role in things, like when you're out hunting and you see like a blue jay and it's going away from you, or because I heard this thing once that they were like messengers to the other animals and they informed the other animals like you were around basically.
You know, those blue jays, I've noticed and I've heard and I've noticed, and they're usually right when they come around you and they're noisier than heck. Somebody is going to leave this world that you know. And when I was younger, I used to think, nah. But now we hear it, And I'd tell my cousins that work with me and some of the other guys, I said, listen to that bird out there, the blue jay. He's making a lot of noise. Just listen and see if something happens. And sure enough, about 9 times out of 10, it does. Mm-hmm. You know, animals are messengers. One example is my uncle and I were in a field, and there was a pile of rocks in the middle. And we were taking a break, and we saw this huge buck coming across. And we ran into those rocks, and we hid there and laid down and got our rifles ready. And he said, you go first. He said, if you miss, I'll go. I said, all right. But there's no way we could miss. This big buck come strolling across, wasn't running. And I had 7 shells in my 30-30. He had 5 in his. I emptied my 7. And he laughed at me, and that buck's still walking. He was probably about 80 yards from us. And he was about 80 yards from going back into the woods. And he said, I'll do it. I said, go ahead. And he emptied his rifle. Never once hit that buck. And he said, something's going to happen. You know, it wasn't very long after that, just a few weeks, his mother passed away. Hmm. Now, we were out sunfishing one day. My uncle and a friend of ours, 3 of us fishing. Oh, my God, we were getting fished left and right. They were just... Every time we threw our hook in water, the fish would come up. All of a sudden, they just stopped. And we could see them down, or they wouldn't take our bait. The one guy I was with us said, hey, we better quit trying to tell us something. So we did. We went back to the house. When we got back to the house, I found out my mother passed away just that time. The last time I witnessed that was 2 years ago during deer season. I was in a cabin, hunting cabin, and this big buck ran across probably 150 yards across the river. This big buck was rolling through. And I told my niece, I said, hey, check this out. She said, oh, my God, that's a huge buck. I ran out there, and I seldom miss. And I shot. And he didn't even jump. And I shot again, and he disappeared into this little woods. Mm-hmm. My other son was straight across from me up on the hill. And I texted him. I said, did you see that big buck? He said, yeah. I said, run down and look for it. See where if I hit it. So he made his way down that hill. And he said, no. Nope. He said, he didn't even hit it. Well, it was probably about a few days later. My brother got severely sick. And we lost him probably a week and a half later. So I'm a firm believer in that animals will tell you things. They're messengers. Mm-hmm. It's not superstition.
Right.
It's just that you got to pay attention to nature and what it tells you.
This is Ojibwe Stories, Gaganunida, a program of Ojibwe culture. Our guest today is Larry Amick Smallwood, a language instructor at the University of Minnesota Duluth. He is also the director of language and culture for the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe and a contributing voice to the Ojibwe People's Dictionary, an online resource created by the University of Minnesota. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how maybe people tend to overdo these signs from nature. In particular, I was wondering about owls, and if people tend to be almost a little paranoid about that, you know what I mean? But yet, people are really paranoid about some of that stuff.
I get a lot of calls. I thought, hey, there was an owl sitting on the road, or hey, there was an owl up in a tree by my house. Yeah, so, I mean, he's a bird, you know. He's, what's wrong with him? Nothing. What shall I do? I smudge my house. Oh, whatever works for you, and, you know, they're just birds, you know, but people get so paranoid over things like that, you know.
Yeah.
But see, people don't take time to try to learn these things.
Mm-hmm.
My age and the next generation older than me, we never took the time to teach our young ones. I have a 7-year-old son, and he's been in the woods with me since he was 4, out deer hunting. And he is learning a lot about the woods right now. He knows how to put his tobacco out. He tells me what to do. I shot a deer in front of him one time. He ran over there and put some sema down for him. Mm-hmm. I did. Okay. Let's go now. And then he was with me all the way through the cutting and quartering process and all the way up till the time he made me fry him a fresh piece of deer meat. But he also goes to big drum ceremonies, and he also goes to the midday ceremonies as well. And he sings a lot of songs, but he's kind of bashful. He also knows some midday songs that he sings too from being around the midday camp. He's gifted in that way. So I'm trying to tell him as much as I can when he's at home with me.
Yep.
By taking him into the woods and all that. He knows how to track deer now. He saw a deer track with a blood trail when my other 2 sons and I couldn't see it. He went and found it, and here it is, and it's a good deal. He's learning at an early age. You know, I got a call about deer, when and when not to hunt deer. We don't usually hunt deer till after the first part of July. Mm-hmm. You know, they're carrying their young ones. And we got to give them a chance to give birth to those young ones and kind of lead them around to show them the ropes a little bit. Plus, we want to give them a chance. It's been a hard winter. We want to give them a chance to fatten up a little bit, you know, before we go and hunt. I was a question a while back about what about for ceremonial purposes. Well, on a rare occasion, you could request, or you can get one of your DNR, tribal DNR people to find you a deer or whatever. But it's pretty much of a no-no to hunt between January and first part of July, especially for does. We got to give them a chance to give birth to our young ones. Kawin Shanabe Dagyu Sesin Madagizado Abitabibu Nagizis Bamago Pamago Shkwabitan Ebing Mut Pigi. Hey, Nain Dagus at the Baggy, you say Nishke Kuida Ogayala knew any Johnny one. Manoada Kinomot Kayagishi. Yeshi Nanduis and Ned knew any Johnny one. Oh, Oshkishi. Mio Pico and Nain Dagus at the Gigus son and the Oshkishi as you go. And the Shkwabitan Ebing. Aske you spin baskets with oh aske she oh only Johnny. You spin baskets with Megwa Gigishkwa new oh only Jonathan going which is no new. Punning it picking up my go and going to Towie Gigi Gigabog you say can bomb a squab at an evening. Me should go easy to get on this. Me Eminik is you got Gigadarma.
I like to hear a little bit about netting on Lake Mille Lacs.
Eske nunga mau gipagadwang netting season is nikadig. Kawin gi kasketu semen ma gwech misazaga getting the bagadwang zam wikagi maja mekwam. We didn't get a chance to do too much netting on Mille Lacs this spring because of the ice. And while I'm talking about netting, we on Mille Lacs are very strict about our nets. Our nets feed us fish. We respect those nets. I have seen and we have noticed other people come with their nets. And when they take them out of their boats or their boxes, they throw them on the ground and take the fish out of them. They drag them across the highway or across the driveway. We never, ever allow our nets to be dragged across the highway or across the road or even to touch the ground. And that's a big no-no. Other tribes, I don't think, are aware of that. Maybe they lost that teaching somewhere. I hope they lost it, but I hope they can pick it back up. We respect those things that feed us, those tools that we have to get what we need to survive. Mm-hmm. And the net is a very important tool. We smudge them. We dry them. We take care of them. And I've seen the old people do that with their traps. They would smudge their traps. They would smudge their rifles. They would give feasts. For all this, they had rifles. They had knives. Had all those things set out there. They would give feasts for a good harvest and these things that they're going to use. And well, they'll be safe with using those knives and those axes right. And those rifles. So, but that's the more traditional people. I don't know if how many people do that. But I can't stress enough how important it is to tell the people not to drag your nets or let them hit the ground. Mm-hmm. Keep them from box to box, boat to box to boat, and hang them up as soon as you get there and dry them out. I know we had a net out on Lake Mille Lacs last night, and somebody in the middle of the night went out and cut half of it off. I don't think it was another Shinabe person, but things like that happen and they shouldn't do that. Right. Respect those things that you use while you're getting the game that was provided to us by the Creator.
And likewise, aren't we supposed to take our nets down then at night too if you're hanging them out to dry or not leave those out at night?
That I've never heard.
Oh, okay.
It might be in another community they do that.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's wrong. I just never heard it. You know, our nets have been hung out, you know, overnight to dry and... But that's how they were taught, and if they do that, fine, that's good. It's showing respect for those nets. The other way they used to net, too, my grandpa's used to do that, but I didn't pay attention. They would net under the ice. And I was asking a few of my friends here the other day, I said, do you know how to net? Because we were about to go netting under the ice, and I don't know how we're going to do it. But I think some of my cousins on Mille Lacs know how to do that. Mm-hmm. But I myself don't know how to do that. But they used to do that, mm-hmm. and I think they still do.
How did that work when you were growing up then, before we got our treaty rights? They let us, practice our treaty rights again. Was it tough when you were kind of growing up as a kid for your family to net and
a lot of people, a lot of people used to sneak net. Mm-hmm. We had to. We found a way. Just like the wild rice, too, this year. Last year wasn't any good. We've seen a lot of rice that got wasted by the storms. And some people don't know how to maneuver through the rice properly. They'll take their boat and they'll turn around in the middle of a nice rice bed and knock all the stalks down, and it'll go the other way and all that. They don't put tobacco out. The same out before they go ricing. So, and while I'm on that subject too, our casinos use a lot of our wild rice in their buffets and their menu. Mm-hmm. We try not to waste our wild rice. We try to use all we cook, okay? When that buffet closes at night, they take all that rice and they throw it away. It's waste. I've been talking about that for 2 years now, about let's not put the rice out there for people to, mm-hmm. let's make it a special order. Then they'll eat it, and then they won't waste it that way. Well. That food is one of our spiritual foods we got from the Creator, wild rice, deer meat, fish, berries, all those things.
The thing I find, too, is people, they go too early.
Go as soon as the season opens. I'll tell you something. I remember back in the 50s, when the old local game wardens, I'll tell you about Basil Irvin down here in Pine County. He would come over and ask the elderly Indian people, the men. There was about three or four men that he would ask, do you think the rice is ripe? Should we open it up? And those old guys would go check. And then that old game warden would come back again the next day, and you think it's ready? And they would tell him, it's ready, or give it two more days. Mm-hmm. And those old men would check, and then they would tell the game warden, okay, it's open it up tomorrow. And he would. It's those old Shinabes that knew when the rice was ready. Now they open it up in late August, mid-August, and it doesn't get a chance to grow. It doesn't get a chance to ripen, and they break it all up. And I said that, respect that rice, or Manadu is going to do something. Sure enough, man, the Creator had that big storm last summer, wiped everything away, took it away from us.
It's true.
So those old people are right when they predict something. Mm-hmm. They know things. Mio, don't get me going here.
That's all the time we have for today. I want to thank our guest, Larry Amick Smallwood, for sharing his stories with us. This is Ojibwe Stories, Gaganunidada. I'm your host, Eric Reddix. To listen again to past episodes of Ojibwe Stories, Gaganunidada, visit the KUMD website at kumd.org and click on Audio Archives. Ojibwe Stories, Gaganunidada, is produced in cooperation with KUMD and the Department of American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota Duluth, with funding provided in part by a UMD Strategic Initiative grant from the Chancellor's Office of UMD, and by N.A. Gekane Dasoyang, the Center for Indigenous Knowledge and Language Revitalization at the University of Minnesota Duluth.